First, let me say that Goat in the Road as a Buddhist center is an overstatement. It's not a center. It's a place where a small group of us practice together. I used to save boy goats from the spring auction, so that's how the place got the name. I'd like to talk this evening about the cultivation of our capacity to be present and the obstacles to being present. In the Buddhist tradition, as I'm sure most, if not all of you know, the possibility of being present is talked about in a number of different ways. In terms of presence, in terms of the cultivation of attention, being in attention in the way that where the attention has the characteristics of stability and some fairly high degree of energy, and intention to be in attention. And I think it's very easy to feel discouraged when we begin to realize that we're not present or in attention a lot of the time. I got an email from someone I've been practicing with for a while who just finished reading an article in the current Shambhala Sun about stages of meditation. And she said, I've been doing constant placement, the beginning practice, for so long, and I'm still terrible at it. She, of course, has one of the reactive patterns of judgment, which I imagine a few of us can relate to. One of the obstacles that I observe for many people in the cultivation of attention or of presence is some notion that we should be able to develop the capacity and then stay present. And to, in a way, discount very brief moments of presence as a way of having a kind of taste for what that's like. And of course, if we can return to being present, being centered and aligned and grounded, resting in the moment on breath in, breath out, if we're persistent about the possibility of reaction arises, note the reaction, come back into attention resting on the body and the breath. If we're persistent and determined, our capacity to be present will begin to develop. I'm teaching a class in Berkeley, an 8-week class on this focus, and a couple of weeks ago I asked people, we've been meeting now for about 5 weeks, and I asked people to write down the patterns that they were aware of reactions that interfere with being present. The winners, hands down, were habitual judgment and anger. Now, that's not true for everybody, but out of a class of 56 people, 39 people had habitual judgment and anger at the top of their list. My experience is that, especially for us in this culture, in this society, the habit of judgment is probably the single biggest obstacle to being present and awake inattention that I know of. So the capacity for presence depends upon, really rests upon, our willingness to be interested and curious about what hinders us from being present. And I think for many people, being interested in our reactive patterns is itself a challenge. Because, of course, if we get caught in the content of the reactive patterns, we experience a kind of sinking, energy sinking, physical body sinking, mental sinking, discouragement. So the trick is to be able to observe a reactive pattern without lingering long enough to get caught by the story that goes with the particular reaction. In the Zen tradition, particularly in the Soto Zen, the central aspect that is present in the meditation hall is wisdom, the Bodhisattva Manjusri, who is often depicted with a sword, a flaming sword, likened often to a surgeon's knife, that is, able to cut through delusion, through ignorance, through whatever is in this basket of reactive patterns. And I want to recommend the practice of cutting reactive patterns in this sense: to notice when a reaction arises and then do the kind of cutting that a movie director is about when he yells at the cameraman, "Cut!" Fairly benign. Just instructions that are useful in making the movie. Cut, that is, note and shift attention to a neutral body sensation, and then a breath in and a breath out. Because the difference between having a reaction arise and getting caught in the content of that reaction over against noting and shifting is huge. In fact, when we can begin to see, oh, there's a pattern here, rather than getting caught by the arising of habitual judgment, for example, and then another arising and another arising, as though each reactive thought of judgment is unique and particular and worth savoring and listening to, guaranteed to sink us energetically. Someone I'm very close to who has a fairly deeply set pattern of habitual judgment started doing this bare noting practice, and in about 3 or 4 days she called me up and she said, "It's a pattern." And of course, in that moment of recognizing, oh, this is a pattern of reactive, a mental reaction, she'd already begin to establish a little more distance to that habit. And that's the point at which then we can begin to be curious about the habit itself. For example, what is the language that carries habitual judgment? Generalizations. Comparison is a subset of judgment. Oh, I had the best breakfast this morning. I don't communicate much about breakfast, But it also begins to be a habit to speak in this kind of generalized way, where I keep slipping into the language which is habitual, which carries the energy and feeling tone that goes with this habit. Now, there are of course, many, many, many reactive mental and reactive emotional patterns. But I commend for all of us some cultivation of interest in what those dominant patterns are that keep me busy with the past and the future, that keep me busy with worrying in the mind, in those ways that mean I'm not present. I sometimes teach with a colleague of mine, a woman named Wendy Palmer, who teaches what she calls conscious embodiment. She's trained in Aikido, but she's also a longtime meditator in the Buddhist tradition. And she does a kind of unpacking, if you will, of what is flagged in the Buddhist meditation traditions for the cultivation of presence. That is, coming back to some detail of physical body, specific body sensation, preferably neutral, and then breath. But she expands this by bringing some heightened awareness of the arrangement of the physical body that goes with attention. Because there is, of course, a way of arranging the body that is more conducive to attention than other ways of arranging the body. If the head for perception, the heart for emotions, and the hara for spiritual strength and stability, if those three energy centers are aligned, if we let ourselves experience gravity with the heaviness or weightedness in the jaw and the arms, breath in, breath out, that's the physical arrangement of the body that's the most conducive to or accompanies this quality of being present or in attention. That can be a very useful reference point, especially if you're someone who's used to getting all your cues about how you're doing by looking at other people's faces. How am I doing? Are you interested? Are you enjoying this? Am I entertaining you? Are you happy about me? And pretty soon, I'm leaning way out like this. Oh, out of alignment. And the trick is to come back into the posture of attention. Not get on my case about this. Just notice and come back into aligned and centered, grounded breath. So it means every time a reaction arises, I have a choice about whether I sink into the content of the reaction or just note, oh, reaction. Come back to this arrangement of the body that is conducive to being present. When I do that, I then begin to develop some interest and curiosity in the reactive patterns that are the most dominant. And of course, curiosity and interest, for those of you who've been meditating for a while, know can be very fruitful. One time, I was doing a weekend where we were focusing on this habit of judgment. And let me say, I'm not talking about any and all judgment. I'm talking about that which is habitual. Feels like it has a kind of life of its own. Just comes up. Because, of course, we make judgments in the course of the day all the time. But what I'm talking about is what comes from our conditioning, often absorbed with, alas, mother's milk. So when we begin to notice, for example, judgment. And every time we note the pattern, we come back to centered and aligned, grounded breath. We begin to have the capacity, the confidence that we don't have to keep sinking or regenerating, re-energizing that conditioned reactive pattern in the mind, but that we can begin to cultivate the capacity to come back into the present moment. So the point then is not to stay present, we might like that, but to keep returning to being present. I've been for a few years part of a group of people looking at the intersection between Buddhism and contemporary art. It's been a very interesting series of meetings. And when we first started meeting, this is a group of people, mostly artists and museum directors and curators. And I would say maybe a quarter of the group has some experience with Buddhist meditation. And for the first number of meetings, the non-meditators were terrified we were going to inflict meditation on them. As one artist said, nobody's going to tell me when to be quiet. So several meetings ago, one of the people in the group who's also a fairly long-term meditator was giving presenting a paper for the meeting. And before the meeting started, she said, you know, I'm tired of this format where we have a responder. We can do that for a little while, but then what I want to do is a Dharma combat. Do you all know what Dharma combat is? Well, it's a big entertainment in Zen, where the teacher, who supposedly has some degree of capacity for presence, sits there, and then all the practitioners come one by one, presenting challenging questions. So it's a chance to put the teacher in the hot seat. Fun. So my friends, it's fun actually for everybody, can be. So my friend said, would you be willing to do a Dharma combat with me instead of having a discussion in my favor? I didn't have a clue how she thought this was going to be relevant, but I said, sure. So we sat down in the middle of the room with everybody around us, and for about 15 minutes, she began to bring forth all of her reactivity. She just visited her family of origin. And she just had a head full of things she was upset about, and trying to rescue her brother from his suffering and get her mother to behave. And just, so I just sat there, and she'd bring things up, and then I'd say something, and then she'd bring something up, and then I'd say something. Sometimes I wouldn't say something. And after about 15 minutes of what I considered on her part great bravery in showing her highly reactive mind out there in front of everybody. She said, thank you very much for your teaching, which I knew meant, okay, let's stop. And I said to her, may your life go well. And we went back to our seats. But we were, in that 15 minutes, completely present with each other. And the people sitting around the edge of the room watching us went. First of all, that the two of us were willing to get up there without a script, without a program, etc. And as my friend said afterwards, well, they just got to watch us fly around the room together for 15 minutes. What was so touching about that episode was that we were both individually and together present with each other in the situation, with some willingness to have it go however it went. And the effect on the group was quite striking to me. Because for the rest of that meeting, there was a sense of everybody having dropped to some deeper way of being together than had been true before. And the members of the group had some, experientially, some sense about, oh, that's what's being pointed to with all this conversation about Buddhist meditation. We just had our last meeting a few days ago. And an artist some of you may know, a woman named Ann Carlson, did a 30-minute, it wasn't a performance, but she spent 30 minutes doing something she called blanket. She took my shawl and put it over her like a blanket and became a very old woman. And she was, for 30 minutes, herself as a very young infant, as a young child, as an adult, as an old woman beginning to lose her mind. And what we all experienced was that for that 30 minutes, Anne was all those ages in that 30 minutes. Not sequentially, but simultaneously. Because, of course, the strands, the voices, the utterances, the cries just came and went and came and went in the way the breath does. And when she sat down, the room was very still. And people were very happy to just sit together, breathing. I'm telling you this because I think that sometimes for those of us who have been lucky enough to meet the Buddha's teachings and to meet the meditation path, this whole articulated path for studying the mind and training the mind and cultivating our capacity to show up, to be present, to understand that this capacity for presence is not exclusive to Buddhism. What is particular to the Buddhist tradition is that there's an articulated path for this cultivation, which is, I think, a great treasure. But I also think that there's something important in being open to our stumbling into those moments of being present in our own capacity and to bumping into somebody who has this capacity as well. The Dalai Lama is not every Dalai Lama, but many Dalai Lamas are called presence. The word in Tibetan is kundun. For any of us who've had a chance to be around someone who has some developed capacity for presence, what happens is, as Sayadaw Upandita said in one of his writings, we don't get to hear about what an apple tastes like. We get to actually take a bite and chew and taste the apple. The actual physical whole being experience of being around someone who's present can be extremely useful. So what I want to encourage all of us to do is to be willing to notice what keeps us from being present, to begin to develop real interest and curiosity, that is, genuine, authentic interest and curiosity in our reactive patterns, keeping in mind Manjushri's sword so we don't linger. We don't get caught in the storytelling. And that we understand that what we're going for is the capacity, the developed capacity to keep returning to the present moment. That we not feel like a failure if we can't abide there for long periods of time. But that we can keep returning. The founder of Aikido, was walking down the street with one of his students. And some tough guy was coming towards them, kind of spoiling for something. And O-sensei did some little something, and instead of a confrontation, just went like this, and the guy went right by. And as he and his student were walking along, the student turned to him and said, "It's so wonderful, you're in attention all the time." And he said, "Oh, no, I'm not. It's just that when I go out of attention, I return so quickly, you don't notice it." When I first heard that story, I thought, how comforting. And that's, of course, how we begin to let ourselves have the taste of what it's like to be present. And after we've had enough tastes, what happens is we begin to have more and more confidence that we will know what to do, what to say, how to behave, simply out of being present, out of showing up. And of course, sometimes what there is to say or do is not to say or not to do. Kind of un-American, but sometimes the best we can do, the most authentic place we can rest in is don't know. We have a certain amount of cultural conditioning about, well, we should know. But it's very important to be willing to not know when we don't know. So, I always like to leave some time for questions and comments and arguments and disagreements, etc. So I wonder if what I've had to say jiggles anything loose for any of you, or is something you'd like to bring up that we might talk about? Or is this a room full of people free of reactive patterns? Yes?
Question. When you were discussing sitting in the room with the other woman and what did you call it? Dharma combat?
Dharma combat, yeah.
Is there really a deep sense of trust when you go to do something like that with each other? Or in a situation where the teacher is basically being confronted with questions, is there sometimes a lack of that? I guess what I hung up on was the sense of, I could see doing something like that if you really were with somebody that you trusted was not going to, go somewhere that you didn't want to go. And then I thought, well, maybe that's not the issue. Maybe it's not trusting that other person as much as being willing to go wherever.
Well, I think it's really a matter of trusting oneself. I think this whole idea of trust gets very complicated because we think that it's about trusting other people. But in this particular situation, this person said, would I do this? And she studies with a quite tough Zen teacher in the East. He's a former Marine. And I didn't really know what she had in mind other than just the format, the setup. But she and I have done a few retreats together, and so let's sit down and see what happens. And as it turned out, the person who was really doing the trust fall was my friend, who was sitting in the student seat and just showing all of her reactivity and worry and conditioning in a way that was just out there for all to see. And for me, what I experienced was enormous respect for her willingness to just let her mind hang out there for everybody to see it, unedited, not dressed up. And I had no idea what we were going to do. Let's just see. Let's find out. What could happen? One or the other or both of us ends up looking like an idiot? Well, that's accurate some of the time. And in fact, I think my friend's description that it was more like we were flying around the room together in terms of a kind of willingness to just touch in mind to mind. But I don't think the question was my trusting her or her trusting me, although she probably had some trust in the asking me if I would do that with her. But more important was trusting myself to sit down and be present, and for her trusting herself to do the same. Yeah, you're welcome. Yes?
In the same context.
Well, she was bringing up, she just come from visiting her brother. And she comes, this is somebody who comes from a very difficult family of origin. And so she was busy with all kinds of advice she wanted to give her brother and the things she wanted her brother to do to have a happier life. And he didn't have confidence in himself. And so she kept bringing up these different things that she saw that were going on with her brother that she wanted to fix. And she'd try one thing and another and another and another. And of course, what I kept seeing was, are you trying to mind someone else's mind stream? Are you trying to save your brother from his own suffering? Is this instead of your own? No, but she would ask questions, and those would be the kinds of questions that I might raise as possibilities to consider. Because, you know, she was talking about a situation that she's in. And all the conversation about her brother and the family and all of that, it's, she's talking about what she was upset about, what she was concerned about, what she felt badly about. And at the same time, she was revealing her own reactive patterns. Being a classic case of what I call driving an ambulance. Or as my kids used to say when I would, in my ambulance driving days, ah, she's on a save. You know what the practice is? The antidote practice? You go to the toy store where they, I know Toys R Us sell these, some place, some toy store that sells little English miniature cars, and you find an ambulance. And you bring it home and you put it on blocks. Somewhere where you'll see it. And you'll know you're in real trouble when you give someone your ambulance. Anyway, does that give you a little sense about what I'm describing?
I think it's the interaction. It somehow doesn't fit for me in what you described before as Dhamma combat, where the person is asking the teacher questions.
But that's assuming that the teacher is supposed to tell you what you're supposed to find out for yourself.
Well, I don't know what Dhamma combat really is, so I'm just trying to understand.
Well, but it's a device in Zen for teacher and student to meet. And, you know, an effective teacher doesn't answer a student's questions, but supports the student to discover how to answer those questions for themselves. Yes?
I've really gotten a lot. I really am grateful for your words. I just want to say that.
Thank you.
But I would like to see if there's any wisdom that you might offer. If one leaves their body alone, during the day, you know, just space out, lose it. I mean, they just cannot be present in conversation with people.
Right.
They drift off. Mm-hmm. Is there any recommendation that you have to come back, to get back in the moment?
Because gravity. Heavy jaws and weightedness in the arms, a sense of real heaviness in the arms, feet flat on the floor. The more attention that comes back into the physical body. Because usually when that happens, a lot of energy is up in the head. And we get kind of floaty and drift away. And the body is absolutely reliable. And, you know, give up leaning and slouching. But I'd go for gravity. Someone I've been practicing with for a number of years suffers from a kind of spaciness or checking out, etc. And she's been working on gravity for a while, and she said, I can't believe how reliable gravity is. At least here. Yes, but simple doesn't mean easy.
Right, exactly.
Simple does not mean easy.
It's easy not to do.
Yeah. Well, notice the spaciness, come back to weightedness in the jaw and arms, the heaviness of the body sitting in the chair, feet on the floor. Yes.
There were three things.
The head for perception, the heart for emotions, the hara for spiritual strength and stability. And if those three centers are aligned, then we're in the physical arrangement that goes with attention or presence. Yeah.
How do you spell that last word?
Hara. H-A-R-A. It's a Japanese word. In Chinese, it's tantian. If you take three or four fingers at the navel, and where three or four fingers below the navel, and the distance of the index finger in. So it's an energy center in the center of the body. So the head, now if your head's out like this, your head is not aligned with the heart chakra or the hara. Or if you're like this, and you know, we all have a tendency to have the head, the heart, or the hara, usually it's the head or the heart, that's the leader, that's the dominant center. And when you start bringing energy into the body and you have this alignment, you begin to have the possibility of having a real connection between the emotional center and the spiritual center in a way that can make a big difference in one's capacity to be present. Yeah. Yes. Oh, I think there are a number of causes. The ones that I'm the most aware of, because they are the causes with particular people that I practice with, has to do with early childhood abuse and trauma, where that was the way, as a very young child, a person could survive situations where they just didn't have the capacity as young children to take care of themselves any other way. And I think it's very important for us to respect what we learned as kids as coping strategies before we try to change them. I think that it's very important to respect those coping strategies rather than say, oh, this is terrible. I'm sure there are all kinds of causes and conditions for kind of spacing out or checking out. But that's what I'm the most aware of, at least these days, because of some of the people I practice with. Okay, one more question. Yes.
I don't tend to run a lot of anger, but I do run a lot of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if that could stop someone from being present also.
Yes, absolutely. Largely not because of the fear itself, but because of my relationship to fear. And most of us have an enormous amount of aversion to being present with fear. And when we're present with fear on the breath, even if it's just for not even a whole breath, we then have the chance to experience that even fear has the mark of impermanence. That it doesn't work to know that intellectually. We have to know it experientially. But when we know that experientially, that can bring about quite an important change in one's relationship with fear. Thank you. That's a useful question to end on. Let me close with this observation. For any of you who have the habit of judgment, the antidote practice is quick, 10 things you're grateful for. It's picking the mind up from that cranky, it's wrong, why don't they do it differently, the window's broken, and putting it on this groove of appreciation and gratitude. And it has an almost miraculous effect right away. It's called the cheap trick. So, thank you very much. Nice to be with you, and nice to see your new home, which is quite wonderful. Thank you very much.